Welcome to this podcast for Classical 91.5. I'm Julia Figueres. Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra conductor laureate Christopher Seaman is back in town, and with him, pianist Andrew Van Ooyen, who made his very debut here almost exactly a decade ago. Welcome back to our studios, Christopher.
Thank you.
So nice to have you. And Andrew, been way too long.
It has.
So let's get talking here about this program that we have ahead of us. The concert begins with a brief but really lovely tone poem by Tobias Picker, Old and Lost Rivers. How do you know this piece, Christopher?
I can't remember. I've done it a few times, but I can tell you that there's parts of the country where there's a disused riverbed up a mountain. And it sort of dwindles away. It used to be a river, but isn't anymore. But you can see from the rock and stone foundations. And I think Picker was sort of fantasizing, if they could tell a story, what would it be? And it's a dreamy piece, a reverie, I would say, actually. And it's in D-flat major, and it stays there, more or less. And it's atmospheric, very calm, lovely opening for the concert.
And it has a sense of longing about it, a sense of nostalgia.
Well, you see, those rivers, they are no longer. We miss them.
And then right after that, Beethoven's Second Concerto with Andrew Van Ooyen as the soloist. So this is actually concerto number one.
In order of writing, yes.
Is this a good concerto? As the Beethoven concertos go, Andrew, there are five. Is this a good one?
People like to rank the Beethoven concerti. I do have my favorite, which is number four, and it has stayed that way for many years. But after that, you know, it just really depends on the year or the direction of the wind, because I happen to love this concerto. And what one thing I could say about the five concerti is each one is completely unique. Key, mood, everything. If you compare this to the Emperor, that's different worlds, in my opinion. I mean, this is written for a young Beethoven. This is written by a young Beethoven. It's very virtuosic in a way, but in a much more classical way than a romantic way.
Beethoven said, this was not one of my best. That was the quote. So what is it about that assessment, do you think, that Beethoven found this lacking when compared to the other four?
The only thing I could say to that is that, you know, if we talk about the fourth concerto, it's so unusual in many ways. The piano begins. There's a very unusual second movement. This dialogue between piano and orchestra. This is somehow much more conventional as a concerto in terms of its structure and the three movements and the keys of the movements. And so perhaps, you know, he considered it inferior just because it was less unique than the others, because it was more conventional. But it's full of absolutely beautiful melodies, brilliant development, and it flows. It has a natural flow. This is not a struggling Beethoven piece. There's some pieces where it sounds like he's constructed it, and as masterfully as he has, there's sometimes a struggle, and there's no struggle in this piece. It's a very seamless work.
It actually does not start with piano at all. In fact, you have to wait almost 3 minutes before making your introduction. It begins with an orchestral theme, Christopher.
Yes, and of course, just as Andrew said, you can tell a bit of Mozart and Haydn in the style of it. It's classical, it's cheerful, it's lively, it's lighthearted, jaunty almost, you could say. And then the piano comes in with a slightly more lyrical entry. But he probably thought, look what I became. What a pity I wasn't what I became when I was young. But we could all say that. And I think that's quite natural for him to have had that reaction.
The first movement is almost half of the entire concerto. It's a rather lengthy movement. Lots of call and response.
Yes, but there's also quite a lengthy cadenza.
Yeah.
And so I am playing the Beethoven's cadenza. Some pianists play their own, but this is such a great cadenza. I don't think I could ever write a better one, or anybody could. And that's also what makes it a little longer than you'd expect.
The cadenzas, Beethoven did write his own. Mozart, of course, there are several cases where there were no cadenzas. Have you written cadenzas?
Absolutely, quite a few of them for Mozart concerti.
But you are not going to do Beethoven.
You know, my attitude is if the composer wrote one, and a good one, and usually in the case of Mozart and Beethoven, if they took the time to write them down, they were pretty good. So if they wrote them, I play them. If they don't, then I consider, do I write my own? Do I play somebody else's? And there may be, let's say I play a piece many, many times in a season, and I might just want to sort of mix things up a bit, and I might write my own.
The second movement of this, I think, is the most interesting movement because it has a very different feel from a lot of the Beethoven second movements. It feels almost like a romance, maybe tinged with regret.
I think it's more hymn-like. It's very spiritual. And as Andrew said, it's not in a shocking key. You know, one of the concertos, number three, is C minor, but the slow movement's in E major, which is a real shock. You know, Brahms did the same in his first symphony, interestingly enough. But this is in the relatively not a foreign key to the first movement. But it has a kind of repose. It has a kind of spirituality about it.
I would agree completely. Yes, it's very... It's a very how can I say there's something hypnotic about it and spiritual and hymn-like, which by the way I should say the first concerto has some of that as well. But it's a beautiful lyrical second movement. I mean the second movement for some people is actually the favorite movement.
Yes, I agree with that. Absolutely. And it's interesting how certain pieces at the very end of Mozart's life, certain of the arias in the Magic Flute, this you can tell that it has its roots in that this movement. One of the Sarastro arias in Magic Flute. This is
right.
Very similar.
Well, this was very close to Mozart in its writing,
yes.
In the timeline itself. Was this particular, because everything that Beethoven did someplace along the line was breaking a rule. This seems like a unique middle movement. If you place it in time with what middle movements were looking like in concertos, this seems to be a big departure from what was being written at the time.
Yeah, I think it was. It was transitional still, even though we're saying this is a very classical piece in terms of the structure of it and in terms of the spirit of the outer movements, I think you're right that it's sort of the second movement is a diversion from that and from that tradition, and it's looking more forward, more romantic. It's more expansive. That's really the word that comes to mind than most classical concerti that we know.
And then you get to your third movement, which, like all the Beethovens, lets you let it rip.
You absolutely let it rip. It has this wonderful jaunty bounce and gallop to it, and he places the sforzandi in places where you would not expect him to be. So there are accents in all kinds of surprising places, which it's just a wonderfully enjoyable, fun, playful movement.
Mischievous almost.
And mischievous.
Yeah,
absolutely.
When you guys, I assume that you sat down and you talked this over before playing it?
Well, I mean, we were going to have about 5 minutes to find... Are you doing the cadenza that ends with the four scales?
Yes.
Oh, well, that's it.
That's pretty much it.
We work very sympathetically together. There's very little to talk about. I might have one question.
You know, soloists say this about Christopher, that he's really a tremendous collaborator when it comes to a concerto. So, Andrew, talk about him like he isn't here.
I'll leave if you like.
What is it?
Well, you know what?
Him?
For me, the litmus test with a conductor is when I'm doing a concerto is do I have to look at them much? And no, with a good conductor like Christopher, an excellent conductor, you do not need to because you just feel it. You feel the phrasing. You feel the support. And so I think there's something very I feel it's a great privilege to work with a conductor like Christopher because I don't have to to have my eye on him and wonder what's happening next.
Christopher, how do you find that groove when you're working with a soloist? How do you
catch
that?
Into their shoes. You know, I'm very fortunate. I was an orchestral player for 4 years, so I know a little bit about flexibility. You went with the conductor and you went with what you heard play in the London Philharmonic, in my case. And I was a cathedral chorister, where you went with what you heard. 36 boys would sing together without a conductor when I was a choir boy. I don't know how we came in together, but we did. And I think that set me up a whole set of reflexes which enabled me to more or less, enable me to follow a soloist. But you see, you don't follow a soloist. You have to anticipate what they're going to do. If you conduct with the soloist, the orchestra will be late, because a lot of them are at the back and hear the soloist late. So you actually have to be, without in any way dictating to the soloist, one step ahead. You have to smell what they're going to do. And I can always smell what Andrew is going to do, because it's very natural and very artistic.
That sounds so tricky.
Yes. Well, it's a tricky job, Julia. You know, let's have some sympathy here.
So the last piece on the program is really a giant work. It is Elgar's Second Symphony. It would be his last symphony as well. He would never finish his third. He said it was a very personal work. He said it was a passionate pilgrimage of the soul. Can you take us on that pilgrimage, Christopher?
Well, yes, that's what he said about it. It's very passionate. The first move was extremely passionate. There's the most glorious second movement, which is a funeral march. And apparently we Brits are very good at royal funerals. And he wrote it. Originally, he was going to dedicate it to King Edward VII, son of Queen Victoria. And Edward VII died. So it was done then as in memory of him, rather than, you know. So that's the feel of the slow movement, a magnificent funeral march, full of grief, full of yearning. And one of the great characteristics of Elgar's music, you feel there's a yearning either for a lost happiness or a happiness he never found. So that really gets to me, I must say. Third movement is a scherzo movement. He calls it Rondo, but it's really demonic. I mean, it is very, very busy, active, and slightly demonic, actually. The last movement is a much more grand British thing. I said to the orchestra yesterday, I want you to imagine that you're by the River Thames in London, and there's a barge slowly going along the river, and sitting on that barge is Queen Victoria. And you get this wonderful picture, because there's a little bit of pride in the movement as well, which is in his period of British history. People are very proud to be British. Well, we're still, but we don't brag about it, you know.
You know, unlike the First Symphony, which got this massive response to it, The response to the Second Symphony was somewhat tepid.
Well, I don't know how good a performance it got, because if Elgar was conducting it himself, Sir Adrian Bolt told me that he never did it the same way twice, and he could have been off form. He was also embarrassed by his own music and used to get through it so it didn't feel too embarrassing. So you can't tell a great deal from that. The other thing about it is it has a quiet, wonderful sunset glow of a finish, not a loud, bashy, rah-rah finish where you jump on your seat and scream. It's got a calm finish, a sunset finish.
Is that more or less difficult for a conductor to have this long and big symphony, and Brahms' Third does the same thing, not on that big rah-rah finish, but something more contemplative?
Well, you just have to be true to the music and hope that it gets across. I think this does get across, actually. I've always found it did. I don't know what you can do. You can't jump around or look agonized or anything, because music's for the ear, not the eye, which a lot of people don't realize nowadays. Isn't that true, Andrew?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, we're teaching people to listen with their eyes. I love that conductor. He was dancing in the Beethoven, come on. Andrew, I love that pianist. Oh, the expressions on his face. Well, if you look at all the great pianists on YouTube, They sat there extremely calm. It all came out. Right. So we're going through a time where we have to look cute in order for the music to sound right.
Yes.
Not that I'm on any kind of crusade here.
Well, I mean, you, Andrew, you are a good-looking guy, but this seems to be kind of the hunt for the next good-looking soloist.
It's pervasive in our culture now. It's not just music. It's in all fields. And I think, yes, we're very visual today. And I think there's nothing wrong with packaging what we do in a very intelligent, visually intelligent way. I think there's nothing wrong with that. I think that's actually very good. I think in terms of the way that though that we realize and display the art, it needs to be done. And as musicians, the music always has to come first. And we need to be listening with our ears, not our eyes. If we can get more people to come to the concerts through a sexy photo, through a whatever, great. But the actual music making, we need to really stay to the core of what that's about.
This has been a conversation that has been going on in classical music, frankly, for quite some time. How do we bring the youngsters in? How do we bring the younger people in? Is that a problem?
Well, it wouldn't be if the schools did what schools used to do half a century ago. I mean, when I was here as music director, I met many, many patrons who'd been coming to the concerts for half a century. And the reason they came was that every week on the radio, heard, listened to in the school, was Howard Hanson, wasn't it, conducting the Royal Philharmonic and talking about the music. And they had a weekly dose of music being introduced. And that gave many of them a love for music, which continued all their lives.
I do quite a bit of work in Asia, namely Japan. And I must say that audiences there are quite different from audiences here. They're much younger. And that I attribute directly to education,
yeah.
Private lessons. I mean, statistics are something like in China now, 1 in 2 kids takes piano lessons or violin lessons. I mean, it's astounding. So I see it at my concerts. I see the difference. But I also don't, I think in the West, classical music has never been a young audience or for many years. I mean, we've always been supported by
people
who have who have somehow been in the older demographic, but nonetheless we cannot let up with the education. As Christopher says, it's the number one thing we can do to basically create our audiences of the future.
When you were talking, I had to go back to something. When you were talking about the second, by the way, you talked about Sir Adrian Bolt, and I was reading about this piece, and apparently Sir Adrian Bolt gave a bang-up job of this that people like much more, so perhaps...
Well, yes, the piece wasn't a success at first, possibly because he conducted it himself and he was off form, and then Bolt decided to revive it, and it was a success. And I've recorded it with Bolt. When I was in London Philharmonic, we made a recording of this symphony with Bolt. And I remember quite clearly quite a few of the things he did. And Elgar said to Bolt, "My reputation is safe in your hands." That is quite something for a composer like that to say to a youngish conductor.
Bolt was a leading light for you.
Yes, one of about half a dozen. But he was very good to me, although... When I joined the orchestra, he thought I was a bit of an upstart, and it took him a year to kind of put me in my place as he saw it. After that, he was fantastic. When I became a conductor, he would listen to my broadcasts. I was with the BBC Scottish Symphony as music director, and I'd get letters from him. I've kept them all. He liked this, he didn't like that, and various ideas he had in his old 80-year-old handwriting. I treasure them.
You were a bit of an upstart as well, Andrew, when you began your career, your orchestral debut with the L.A. Phil, was it? How old were you?
16. I made my orchestral debut in a concerto, a soloist, at the age of 10. And then
Which concerto, Andrew?
It was the one that everybody plays as their first concerto, practically. It was the Haydn D major.
Oh, yes.
So how have you successfully, because it has been... 10 years since we've seen you last, how did you successfully get yourself from that 10-year-old to the 36-year-old you are now in one piece? Because it doesn't always happen. These child prodigies often burn out.
Right. Well, fortunately for me, I never had the opportunity to have that, to go through that sort of the question of burnout, because my career never happened overnight. It was always a gradual thing. And a number of events occurred that helped develop my career at a very gradual pace, namely winning the Gilmore Prize, well, beginning with the playing with the LA Phil at age 16, then winning the Gilmore Prize, then getting my first agent, and then getting subsequent agents in different regions in the world. And so it was never, and now signing, I just signed a few months ago with Warner Classics. So all of these sort of milestones have all sort of happened gradually, not all at once. And I think if they happen all at once, you really run the risk of burning out and getting too many opportunities too soon that you are not ready for.
Absolutely right.
One of the things that strikes me is you said you played Haydn, and these days you see an awful lot of youngsters coming in and sitting down and playing Rock 3. And is this a mistake to be putting something that size into hands that young?
Sure. It's a mistake in terms of physically speaking. It's also a mistake that a lot of young musicians are giving repertoire that are given repertoire they are not prepared to play emotionally. And now Rachmaninoff does appeal to young pianists, I think, better than more than Schumann, for example, or Schubert. But still, you have to be careful. And I was very fortunate to have teachers who always watched out for. I was actually always very fortunate to have teachers who really gave me good technical instruction, but also properly guided me in repertoire.
You see this a lot with these young kids who are going onto these television talent shows and singing arias. And I cringe. I think, what happens to them in 5 or 10 years?
Oh, for singers, it's super precarious because they... It's easy for an agent to say with a singer, oh, gosh, I can make a lot of money with this artist now and just have them sing here and there, and then the singer's done. You know, it's even easier to destroy a singer than an instrumentalist.
Have you worked often with young players, Christopher?
Oh, yes. Many, many times. And I love it. But I think Andrew's made a very crucial point. Physically, if you overtax a young pianist, something happens to their technique which could land them in trouble later. And even more with young singers, when young singers are overparted, given stuff that their voice isn't ready for, they could end up not singing by the time they're 40. And Birgit Nilsson, I think, or was it Kirsten Flagstaff, one of the two great Wagner sopranos, what advice would you give a young singer? Leave Wagner alone. That was there. Which of them was it? Do you remember? I don't remember. It was one of the two.
When you worked with Andrew 10 years ago, was that the first time
yes.
that you'd worked together? So have you seen each other in 10 years?
We have a few times.
Yes,
we did. We've done several concerti together in different cities, and we've done the Schumann together.
Oh,
we've
yes.
done Beethoven Emperor together, and so we're back to Beethoven again
nice.
This weekend.
What have you been doing for the last 10 years?
The last 10 years. I can hardly believe it's been 10 years. Well, my repertoire has even... We were talking about repertoire a second ago. I mean, my repertoire has certainly grown. I can tell you that, for example, this season alone, I'm playing about 15 different concerti. Mm. Now, I have to be careful because that's a lot. That really is a lot. Most of them are concerti I have played. But... So over the past 10 years, my repertoire has definitely grown. I have been, you know, continuing to work regularly, you know, in North America, but now more in Europe. This year I'm doing quite a bit. I'm also doing some conducting from the keyboard, which
Are
is exciting.
You?
Playing in Asia. And this year I'm playing in Israel for the first time. So I guess my... I'm expanding myself geographically as well.
When I looked at the questions that we had on the list 10 years ago, one of the things that I commented was, your repertoire is all over the place. You
and that's a choice. That's really that's definitely a conscious choice. I really choose only to play music that I'm close to. But I that's not to say I do everything equally well. But I'm one of those pianists. I think there's sort of pejorative connotation to being a generalist, but my repertoire, if you look at it this season, it's kind of that. I'm playing about 15 different concerti. And so that's just but that's who I am. I can't see myself, you know, I can't see myself playing the same concerto literally, although I've done it before, 15 times in a season. I've done that, actually did that on tour once in 1 month, you know, doing the Rock Second. And that's okay, but I prefer, even though I'm making my life more difficult for myself, I actually prefer to have this kind of diverse repertoire, yeah.
And conducting, have you talked to at all to Christopher to get a few tips?
No, we haven't talked about it at all.
Well,
but you know,
if he's conducting from the piano, it's not quite the same as getting up and doing the Rite of Spring.
I
have every confidence that he would be excellent at.
Yes, but you have conducted from the jangle box, so you know.
Well, yes.
See, we have one advantage when we conduct from the keyboard. That is, if our musicians, our orchestra cannot understand what we're doing with our arms, we can always play on the piano. We can give them a demonstration of what we want the orchestra to do.
And Christopher, how has your year been since you were here last?
Oh, well, I've done a bit over here. I went to Cincinnati and I went to Milwaukee. I did a world tour with New Zealand, Canada, and ended up in Honolulu. Went to Brazil. Yes, it's been quite varied, actually.
And now that you tend to be calling your own shots wherever you go, you know, picking things, have you been able to pick out things to play, to conduct in orchestras that maybe you hadn't gotten to program or program enough?
Well, now and again, a piece that I'm very, very fond of, I'm given the chance to do somewhere that I haven't done for years. But yes, I occasionally add new things, but I've got a very big repertory, most conductors have, and I just want to keep all of it alive. I mean, when you have that many pieces, hundreds of them, you know, you want to keep them alive.
And you know, before we go, I did want to ask you this, Andrew, because, again, I looked at my questions, and 10 years ago, I asked you where you thought you'd be 20 years from now, from then. Well, we're now halfway through that mark. Has anything surprised you along the way? Has this gone as you expected or no?
You know, a career like ours is always full of surprises. I think it's a mistake to expect things are always going to go a certain way in every sense. I think some opportunities have come my way that I never thought I would get. Certain orchestras, to play with certain orchestras, to a recording contract, things like that. But there's also certain things, of course, that you see, well, I thought I would be playing more in this region of the world or more, or getting asked to do this repertoire more, and it doesn't happen because you can't control necessarily what you're asked to play. And where, you know, how you are, how presenters will also view you, because this is also something that is very important in our business, branding, and so in what I've also come to learn in our business is you can have different brands or identities in different markets, and in Europe you can be known for one composer or group of composers, in the States for different ones, so. There definitely, I'll tell you this much, 10 years ago, I think I probably told you I wanted to just keep doing what I'm doing, and which is playing a lot of concerts, and concerti, recitals, chamber music, and I feel very fortunate, that this is, I'm getting to realize that life, and, I have since then and continue to.
You've seen some great successes. The recording contract alone is huge, because not a lot of those are coming out of the doors these days. So you've done so well. It's great to have you back.
Thank you, Julia.
Congratulations on all of your successes. We look forward to hearing this concert. And Christopher, you know we always love you in this house.
Thank you.
So I'd like to thank our guests, Christopher Seaman and Andrew Van Ooyen, for taking this time to be here. If you'd like information about the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra season, you can go to rpo.org. I'm Julia Figueres, and this podcast is a production of WXXI Public Broadcasting.